It's August 1st, 1997. We're in Palo Alto, talking to Jerry Underdahl. I always begin by asking you what your birth date was.
December 10th, 1943 in Shelby, Montana. Mm-hmm.
And what were your parents' occupation when you were born?
My mother was a housewife and my father, when I was born, he was a traveling salesman. Mm. They were divorced when I was quite young, and so my dad was a railroad telegrapher.
Your stepfather?
My stepfather.
Your stepfather was a railroad telegrapher.
Yeah.
Did either of them have any college education?
My mother had 1 year at Pacific Lutheran. Hmm.
And that leads me to actually the next question. Did they have any religious orientation when you were growing up?
Yes. Let's see. Well, I grew up in the Assembly of God Church, mm-hmm. and my mother's background was sort of fundamentalist Presbyterian type, mm-hmm. but they weren't there, and my natural father was Lutheran. My stepdad was nothing in particular.
Mm-hmm. And so you ended up going to church when you were little at a
Assembly of God Church. The whole time.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And did you ever, where did you graduate from high school? What high school was that?
Shelby High School.
Shelby. And did you ever think before you went to college that you'd ever do anything international or overseas?
Yes.
Why was
that? I was just interested in foreign things. Mm-hmm. It seemed kind of remote and exotic. Mm-hmm. My brother sort of stimulated that thought too when I was going to college. He was mm-hmm. saying, well, one of the nice things about Stanford is that they have an overseas center where you can go and find out about places to study or travel abroad. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know if I could do it, but it seemed possible and I was interested.
Your older brother had gone to Stanford when you were
he did 1 year of law school here. Mm-hmm. He went to Montana State mm-hmm. University, actually, for his regular university, but when I was applying to schools, he was down here and saying that would be something nice about it.
And where did you go to college?
I went to Stanford.
To Stanford.
Yeah.
Huh. Mm-hmm. And what did you get your 4-year degree?
History.
In history. Mm-hmm. Did you ever take any non-U.S. history classes?
I did. Mm-hmm. Asia seemed really remote to me, mm-hmm. but I did take a history class on Asia, but it's funny, I found myself more interested in older Asia than more recent. Mm-hmm. Just seemed less, it seemed like maybe I could get more of a handle on it. Actually the area that I was most interested in, I took a course on the modern Arab world. Mm-hmm. Poli-sci course that was really largely history, too, mm-hmm. from a woman who was just really outstanding.
Who was that, Jim?
I don't recall.
That's okay, it was
right
only
now.
Professional interest.
So. Yeah.
And then there
was one course on African history mm-hmm. taught by a visiting scholar at the Hoover Institution. Mm-hmm. A 3-unit course, the only thing on Africa, basically, that was offered. And I found that really fascinating. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in other areas, other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. When you finished your BA in history, did you have any idea of what you were going to do with it?
No.
And that's why you applied for... So what did you do, not having any idea and a degree in hand?
Well, I had some idea. I suppose teaching was one possibility, but I didn't really, it wasn't that was a goal. It was just sort of, we'll see what happens. I went into the Peace Corps right after college. Mm-hmm. But that was something that was a goal. Mm-hmm. My first international experience, actually, was the 2 quarters at Stanford in France when I was a sophomore. Mm-hmm. And learning French and just being around people who were interested in a whole range of things, the politics and the economy and the literature and culture. And so that was my first real
exposure. What got you interested in that program?
Well, I don't know, it was just one of the first things that caught my eye when I was looking at the materials.
Mm-hmm.
And that my chance to actually get overseas.
Mm-hmm.
See, some kids went over on their own.
Mm-hmm.
This is 1960. I started school in 61.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the really adventuresome ones were ones who were kind of just checking out and going and attending some college overseas.
Mm-hmm.
or stopping out and traveling or whatever. You know, that wouldn't have been my style, but mm-hmm. to go and do the Stanford in France program
mm-hmm.
looked like a really good opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And,
did it have anything to do with the fact that you came from a relatively small town, that being involved in these kind of things was expanding the horizon you felt you needed to do? That ever occurred to you?
Oh, well, sure, mm-hmm. yeah. In a small town, I always felt that things were happening outside, out there,
mm-hmm.
somewhere. It's only in later years that I can look and see what I missed.
Yes, but there are some small towns that are just better that they die. or people in them,
yeah.
In that they can make life miserable. But
yeah.
In any event, when you applied for the Peace Corps and you were accepted, where were you mm-hmm. assigned?
Gabon.
Mm-hmm.
And
do you put your French to good use?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My criteria were, I want French speaking, Black Africa, basically.
Mm-hmm.
One of the forces too, when I was in college, the civil rights movement was really moving through and very active at the
mm-hmm.
Stanford campus. There were some people on campus who were very important in setting a tone and for having activities and sort of making people think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And to my mind, those were linked then in with going into Peace Corps
mm-hmm.
and going to Africa, and you know, that similar mishmash of idealism and just time in your life coming together.
And what did you get out of the Peace Corps experience?
I got a sense that I could do pretty much what I set my mind to do,
mm-hmm.
or that there are ways to get things done. That was a very important
mm-hmm.
lesson to learn. It was kind of nice doing it with all the backup and support that Peace Corps could provide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just got a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
and things are taken care of for you, travel arrangements and whatnot. And you've got a Peace Corps doctor in country and various things like that. But it was a remote, it was an image Peace Corps situation.
Mm-hmm.
Out in the bush, a lot of interaction, with a very different culture and very different environment.
What was your job?
It was a school construction project
mm-hmm.
that I trained for. And the training was interesting, too, because it was handled by Southern University, which is the historically Black college just outside of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And this is 1965, at
mm-hmm.
the same time that there are, people are getting their heads beat in
mm-hmm.
For being white in Louisiana. So the training was there, and then the other part, actual practicing building stuff, was on St. Croix down in the Virgin Islands. So we got a lot of...
Gee, that was
very,
awful. What a
very
terrible experience.
Varied experiences.
Yes. Yeah.
But then when I got there, I wound up teaching for the... sort of an abbreviated school year, because France didn't send as many school teachers down as they ordinarily did
mm-hmm.
to man the secondary schools. And some of us were seconded to the Ministry of Education to teach
mm-hmm.
with the understanding that if we wanted to, we could go back in and go to a village to do the school construction after the school year, which is what I did.
Mm-hmm.
So I got both kinds of experiences.
Mm. And when it came to an end?
Well, I considered extending for a third year. Yeah. sort of playing various scenarios. I took the Foreign Service exam. We were all encouraged to do that, and played with that. Thought about area studies, you know, coming back and going into African studies someplace. Two, three places, UCLA, I guess, and Wisconsin, and, you know, handful
of
places.
Those are good choices. I've gone to both of those schools.
Yeah, handful of places to be looking at. And then also the teaching option was still one that I was interested in looking at. So I applied, took the GREs there and applied to Harvard grad school for the MAT program in social studies. And got results back, offering me a 2-year grant, National Defense Education Act money,
yeah.
to study there. Mm-hmm. And so I took them up on that, and took my time traveling back to the United States from Gabon, and then touched base with my draft board when I got back. This would have been summer 1967. Mm-hmm. So the 2 years that I was in Africa, 1965 to 1967, were 2 years during which the U.S. involvement in Vietnam and the attention to it was changing a great deal. Mm-hmm. While I was there, my perspective on Vietnam was largely a French perspective. I read L'Express magazine, which is their counterpart to Time and Newsweek. And they had a number of articles talking about France's experience in Vietnam. I remember a good series, I think, taken from a book about the French general, Delatte, who had talked America into believing that their fight to hold Vietnam was the same as America's fight at that time developing in Korea. As a consequence, France got the money to prosecute their war and continue it. The other part of it was the French sort of look on it that poor Americans, they're getting drawn into the same thing that we have that we did. Thank God we're out of it. And those poor Americans, they're getting into it. They're doing everything that we did. These are the same roads that are getting blown up, you know, as our guys did. And they're just making the same mistakes. So that was sort of the viewpoint that I had in large part. Vietnam seemed really remote and far away to me. Some of my friends, as we were getting set to finish up, were considering taking AID assignments.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Considering applying to AID, they were encouraged to do so by an AID guy there in Gabon. Hey, go to Vietnam, become an AID, what do they call it, corps advisor or something of that sort. And I wasn't particularly interested in that. Some of the others, were looking at various things.
Hold on 1 second. We'll need to close the window if we could.
Okay.
There we go. So you were mulling those options.
Oh, yeah. So I was going to come back and see if I could go to school. Mm-hmm. Of course, the obstacle was going to be the draft board, because I had... When I applied for Peace Corps, there was no question in anybody's mind, whether it would be allowed. This is 1965. It was still pretty lax, really, in terms of draft pressure. Mm-hmm. They were starting up. But it wasn't, at that point, for me anyway, as if there was any conscious choice. That's just that was my plan all along. But by 1967, the tone had changed quite a bit, and they were tightening up, so I did need to make the request, and I still expected that it would be passed. Mm-hmm. But I also figured that my draft board was generally fair. And sure enough, I got called in and talked with the lady who ran the draft board.
Where was your draft board?
In Shelby, Montana. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, Gerald, we can't do this. You know, we gave you your 2 years to go off there, but now you got to do your military.
How old were you then?
23.
You had 3 years left, really. After 26, they wouldn't be talking to you, but you were 23.
Right.
They said, and now it's time to do your...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was I 23 or 4? Let's see. Mm-hmm. So you turned 20? 23 and a half going on 24. Okay.
But by the way, they were under tremendous pressure because rural draft boards only had a limited number of 19 to 26-year-olds.
Hmm.
So they were much more... Some of them didn't even accept IBS exemptions.
Mm-hmm.
And they were supposed to. So... It took like senatorial pressure
mm-hmm.
to get them to honor them sometimes because they were so pressed.
Mm-hmm.
So they told you.
So they told me no, mm-hmm. no, you got to do your military. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a letter and I thought about it and I talked and I said, well, look, you know, I've been off in the jungle, you know, for 2 years. My brain's turned to mush, but I've got this government scholarship, you know, National Defense Education Act scholarship that's mm-hmm. for 2 years. Please let me do. This first year, part of it, and then you know I'll do the second year when I can. But also that'll give me time to look at my military options. And so they agreed to give me that extension, academic deferment for that year, but with the caution, this is all you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got to do your military.
Mm-hmm.
So I was. Mulling over various things, you know, going and checking out officer training programs and considering various military options and non-military. When I went back then to Cambridge, it was, I knew that I had basically 9 or 10 months before my rendezvous in whatever form it was going to be mm-hmm. with the Vietnam situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really... appalled at what the United States was doing there.
You had become appalled.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Why had you become appalled?
Well, in part, it was just seeing parallels between descriptions of village life in Vietnam and my own having been in villages mm-hmm. in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that... there's a movie that I saw shortly after I got to Cambridge called A New Face of War, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
Just... seeing that, and then Felix, not Felix Green. Who was the guy that said the Australian leftist who wrote several books? Wilfred Burchett.
No, Wilfred Burchett. Yeah.
Right. Well.
Burkett.
Burkett.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, saw one of the movies that he had done on Vietnam, and so there are a number of things that.
Hmm.
That you know, give this sort of insane kind of set of options that you're considering there, and I got back to Cambridge. I was living with two former Peace Corps friends
mm-hmm.
from the same project, who didn't at the time consider themselves to be under the gun in the same fashion that I did,
mm-hmm.
You know, we're strongly anti-war too. One of them wound up going into IBS in Laos, as it turned out.
Who was that?
Max Goldenson.
Mm-hmm.
So that year it was really hard to stay focused on studying and becoming a teacher
mm-hmm.
when I knew that it was just a crazy year. And considering options that range from going to jail, going to mm-hmm. Canada, you know, getting into an officer's training program, and trying to find another way to get to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
Was a little bizarre
mm-hmm.
and really stressful. So that other track of trying to find a way to get to Vietnam on my own terms.
So why would you want to do that?
Well, it was my generation's war,
mm-hmm.
honestly, and I felt that was it. You know, World War II was
mm-hmm.
the previous generation's war, and that shaped what everybody thought. thought and did, and the examples that they drew, and what they spoke of, and all that. Well, my generation's war, for good or ill, mm-hmm. was the war in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and that's proven absolutely true. Mm-hmm.
No, I'm a bit amused because I'm a little younger than you, mm-hmm. although I face the same problems, and Oliver Stone is about your age, mm-hmm. and that was the same reason why he went to Vietnam as an infantryman, mm-hmm. and that his solution was, you know, this is my generation's war, and it's gonna color everything that happens, and he wanted to be a part of it, mm-hmm. and there's several IVSers who said that. My attitude, unfortunately, was different because I didn't know IVS existed. Mm. So I never, there was never any option of going to Vietnam other than with a gun in your hand. Mm-hmm. And that's too bad. I mean, it's a lot of people met these people like the Walkers and, Gene Stolfus or anybody who spoke on campuses, mm-hmm. and said, oh, there is another way of going. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate that people didn't have that option. Did you encounter IVS in Cambridge?
I talked to somebody who was on leave from AID and was taking courses there at Harvard at the time, mm-hmm. and asked him about, and he'd been in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and so I asked him about ways to get there, mm-hmm. and he mentioned IVS to me. And also I had seen, while I was in Africa, I did have a subscription to Time Magazine. That was one of the perks that you got as a Peace Corps volunteer. Mm-hmm. You had a nice library and subscription to Time and Reader's Digest. But there was an article on IVS in early 1967. So that made me aware that there was this organization as well. Mm-hmm. So early on, I contacted IVS. It was probably late October or November, mm-hmm. of that one year that I was going to be there, and was encouraged to come down and have a talk with John Hughes and I'm trying to remember the name of the man who was the head of IVS at the time, an ex State Department man or AID man, sort of looked suitably ambassadorial, had a good talk and was extended an invitation then to join the IVS education team, mm-hmm. When that happened. So I knew that, I think in January probably. Of course, then the Tet Offensive came.
And how did that influence your the timing of your arrival?
Well, there's a real question as to whether they were going to cancel the program or not. You know, they had that meeting where they called everybody in, and, mm-hmm. and you know, Don Luce and Gene and Stolzitz and others resigned, and the question was whether to continue the program. Mm-hmm. And I believe their position was keep the program in large part to have witnesses to what's going on here. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, the program was pared down considerably, and they did, though, keep and plans for a new group to go in of, I think we were about a dozen of us teachers that were going in. John Schaefer was in the same group. Mm-hmm. But that was very troubling times, waiting there to decide, because if that fell through, then I'm back in the soup again as to various ways to deal with the Vietnam question. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you mentioned about the draft boards. You're absolutely right, because I'm accepted there. Then I've got to apply for deferment, you know, at my local draft board, mm-hmm. in Montana, mm-hmm. which of course they denied. Mm-hmm. And so I was just fit to be tied, because of course you can appeal a decision. Right. Where are you going to appeal to? Butte, the state board in Montana? It's going to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. But I talked to the former Peace Corps, the head of the program, chief of party in Gabon, who's working in Washington, D.C. at the time. I said, look, where are you living? Cambridge. Consider your representative to be Tip O'Neill. Mm-hmm. Call him, right? Deal with it as a Massachusetts resident rather than Montana resident. Mm-hmm. You know, call his office, see what they think might happen. I called them and they said, have your appeal to the Massachusetts Appeal Board. Because, I mean, with the stuff that they're going, people coming down and you know, pretending to be sick or just screwing up our intake centers and everything, they'll be delighted with somebody who says, you know, let me go to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So I appealed to the Massachusetts Board. They granted it. And then administratively, as far as draft and everything, then I was set to be able to go to Vietnam. And right at that time, too, in that spring, after the Tet Offensive, is when the general guidelines for the draft and draft deferments were thrown up in the air. And virtually all graduate students then were scrambling. This was the spring of 1968. Mm-hmm. Scrambling to figure out what they were going to do, because all of a sudden many of them were losing their deferments. Mm-hmm. So Max Goldenson, one of my roommates, wound up applying to IVS too and going out to Laos. And Ted C, the other one, applied to and helped organize the, the legal services Peace Corps kind of thing. Is a program where they went into inner cities and did legal work.
Oh my goodness.
Anyway, that was his way of handling it. Mm-hmm. So, ta-da! That got me out after that fabulous year, sort of like a field trip to the East Coast, which included assassinations of various and sundry figures, the stepping down of the President of the United States, and all of these things. And then I set off to Vietnam, feeling that probably I was not going to be there the full 2 years.
Because
this folly is ending. It's going to be wrapped up before then. Johnson's out. He's been pushed out. They're not going to be able to keep this stuff going on till 1960. Well, what would it be?
1973 for us.
Till 1970.
Right.
It's not going to go to 1970.
You went to Harper's Ferry for an orientation?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any of the speeches or the person, any IVSers, returned IVSers who spoke to you?
I remember Gene's talking to us. Mm-hmm.
Was it Gene? Do you remember him ducking under the table when there was a thunderclap when he was lecturing to you?
No, I don't.
John does.
Yeah.
He said that, you know, it's like, I guess we really understood what was going on when you've got a guy who's got, it's called hypersensitivity to stimulus, which is a form of PTSD.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Okay, so that got us...
Well, you're going to teaching. Did you do any TESOL instruction in Washington before you left? Or did you get any...
There was no training there. No. Mm-hmm. I had some experience by teaching ESL when I was in Gabon for that part of that year.
I mean, you're a perfect IV. I mean, for an educationist, I don't think you can get better credentials than the ones you took to Vietnam.
No.
So that was...
No. The French even came in handy with some of the old-timers in the school. In the school system. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Only the very old-timers.
Right, right.
What was your first impression when you got to Vietnam? You must have got there... Normally, these groups went out in July. Was that about when you went
out? Yeah. Well, you already know that we had an orientation there in the Washington, D.C. area, which was, you know, interesting in its own right. And we had went down to the Vietnamese embassy and had a little meeting there.
Did you meet the ambassador?
Yes. I'm trying to remember if it was there or in Hawaii. I know that we met him in Hawaii, and I think that may have been the first time. He didn't make a big impression specifically.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was Wei Xian, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. He's a good friend of mine.
Oh, really?
Really, it's a quite an interesting relationship I've had with him. He lent me the first computer I ever used.
Oh, huh,
and I wrote a book on it, so I owe him. I owe him just about everything. Yes, I do. I really do. And he's a rather special person. And also because he was so distant from what was going on in Vietnam, there's a kind of moral and ethical dilemmas that other South Vietnamese leaders had to face. He was relatively aloof from. Mm-hmm. So it gives a better perspective. He has some interesting things to say. His book's very interesting if you haven't read it. Mm. Jaws of History.
Uh-huh.
It's a very good book. I mean, it's a book you can sit down and just read.
Mm-hmm.
It's co-authored by a good author as well, but you can hear, you know, knowing him.
Yeah.
I know it's a good book. But it was something unusual. This did not happen before. But you went to Hawaii briefly.
Yeah.
Do you know why you were in Hawaii first? What that was for, the program in Hawaii?
Well, it was a language familiarization program in part. It was actually a, sort of a mini program. There was a training center there for AID, mm-hmm. training their officials who were going to be going out to the provinces and whatnot. And so we got a chance to listen in on some of the same or kind of, I remember, discussion of a simulation, a role play mm-hmm. that they would do. And somebody's going, and you're this young AID official, and you've got access to all these goodies, and you've got these various people that you're interacting with in the Vietnamese context. Mm-hmm. You know, how are you going to handle this? And I'm just thinking, God, I'm glad I'm not coming here carrying all that stuff, mm-hmm. you know, the cement and the, you know, the this and the that and the other thing, because, you know, I'd seen that kind of thing in on a smaller scale. I was coming into going to Vietnam basically with the thought that I don't expect anything positive to come from this experience, mm-hmm. but my goal is to not make things worse. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to kill anybody, and you know my presence there isn't going to be you know a drag on the place there, mm-hmm. and you know that was you know pretty low expectations. As things worked out, of course, I benefited greatly from the experience. Had, you know, and got just a great deal out of it. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't going with the thought that, boy, this is just going to be great. I'm just so eager to go over and teach English to Vietnamese because that's terribly important to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. But that program in Hawaii was interesting. We had a very good teacher. I forget her name. She was French-Vietnamese, mm-hmm. Charming woman with a young child who helped us with the sounds. And then we met a really remarkable man, a linguist, Liam. Nguyen Dan Liam, I believe his name was. He was a Vietnamese linguist who was working with him, who subsequently, several years later, committed suicide. I heard he was on the faculty at the University of Hawaii. Mm-hmm. But he really taught us a lot about the family structure and just the complex terminology, relationships, and things. So it was quite an experience. And then we head over with a stop in Japan for our first real Asian experience, and then down to Vietnam. My impressions out at the trying to think of the IVS house, which I'm sure you've heard of that. That was the center out there. Mm-hmm. On space that belonged to the agriculture ministry, I believe. Mm-hmm. But the big fans whirring around and sort of looking in awe at some of these volunteers who would sort of float in and out, realizing, man, they've been here, you know, mm-hmm. for a while. They know what's going on, and they've been around here when the Tet Offensive took place, and they know the language and all of these things. Sitting down, I suppose Danny Whitfield talking to us about transportation and the helicopters flying back and forth overhead constantly, mm-hmm. because it was out close to a hospital, mm-hmm. there that was and also pretty close to Tunsinhut Air Force Base. And then from there we went to Da Nang for some further language training at a public high school up there. And after that, off to our posts. And mine was this little town just south of Da Nang called Hoi An, which is one of the most beautiful little towns in Vietnam. Have you been there?
No, no, but I've seen photographs of it. There's no question about it. It's
just
so beautiful.
It's just a charming place. But when I was there, it was one of the saddest places that I could imagine. Just the weight on it constantly. I'd hear reports from other volunteers off elsewhere in the country where the security situation was less pressing around the edges of the town all the time. Mm-hmm. And talking about things that just seemed just remarkably free and easy to me, being able to get out and just drive off into the countryside and visiting here and there. Hoi An was, that area was an area where there was just constant military stuff going on out in the countryside. Ambushes and counter-ambushes and Korean base set up to protect the coastline between there and Da Nang, and the Vietnamese CIA and the American CIA, and just nasty stuff. And yet in the middle of it, people trying to lead their ordinary lives in this charming ancient town flooded with refugees. And you know, just with touches of color and culture that were
Why do you think
intriguing.
The town was flooded with refugees?
Well, there were free fire zones, you know, just one island beyond, out in this river area. You go past that island, which was okay territory, and then you get on the other side, and it was a free fire zone. Also, back up towards the hills, the Viet Cong put a lot of pressure on people there. They'd be pressed into duty as porters if they weren't, you know, if they were there. People would come in. I mean, they were just getting squeezed from both sides, and the Viet Cong were operating quite close to the town as well. From Hoi An down to the beach, it's a distance I think of about, I don't know, maybe 10 kilometers or something like that. That was no go zone. You know, kids would come in to school from there, some of them, you know, that could afford it or who were in there, and so you'd have this strange feeling. Well, these kids during the day they're in government-controlled area, and they're in my classroom, and they go back at night, and they're in an area that's controlled by the other side, or they have to be concerned about the other side, or their parents may be, or their older brothers may be active on the other side. And
well, there's an interesting argument about how effective the VC was after the Tet Offensive. What was your impression?
I didn't really have a basis.
Yeah, so what was it like before?
Basis to judge. You know, there was a follow-up attack on Hoi An and many other towns the next year, the next Tet, much smaller in scope than the previous year. But I don't know if you've heard the term, what was they called? County fairs. Okay? They organized county fairs there outside of Hoi An. I'd hear about them occasionally from a guy who was a Navy MILFAP guy who was there in Hoi An, talking about taking part in the county fairs. I also remember this kind of anecdote, meeting this guy. There was a very small American military compound just a couple blocks from where I was living in Hoi An. They deliberately kept the American presence, military presence in Hoi An small, trying to make sure that they had defenses all around it. But the theory was, well, this is GVN territory. Hoi An actually was the provincial capital. Da Nang wasn't. Hoi An was. But with this little compound. But I remember meeting this one guy in the bar over there at the compound, who was just so incredulous and fascinated with the idea that during the day I was teaching English to Vietnamese high school kids, you know, and just leading a regular life, and they were leading a regular life. And he worked for intelligence, military intelligence. Now, saying this guy probably cranked the, you know, or ordered the crank on the electrical torture devices to be getting information out of the folks that they would be bringing in for interrogation, because that was going on there. Mm-hmm. You know? And I just knew that among these people that I would see when I'd, you know, occasionally go over there onto that that little base, mm-hmm. hey, if it's being done, these guys have got to be the ones that are doing it. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a bizarre feeling. Mm-hmm. Another feeling that I had there was the sense that these military guys here have more in common with the Germans. There's some Germans who were there in Da Nang with the military, with the hospital that mm-hmm. Germany put up as their show of solidarity yeah. in this multilateral, or this effort mm-hmm. to oppose communism. Mm-hmm.
they built a hospital.
They had a boat that they brought into uh-huh. Da Nang's hospital, and they had auxiliary crews at the town side around. Mm-hmm. I was saying, you know, my feeling was that American soldiers would have had, right after World War II, would have had more in common, felt more in common with their German former enemies, even mm-hmm. if they were in a bar, than these American GIs and soldiers did with their Vietnamese counterparts.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think, why was that?
Just racial. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for a lot of American soldiers, you know, the enemy was Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. And,
so what was your daily life like? You'd get up and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, get up, often go out and get some pho or some boom ba or mm-hmm. you know, some sort of noodle soup for breakfast. And
mm-hmm. go well, where did you live? Did you live in a house with another IVSer or?
Yeah, mm-hmm. there was a house that had been rented by IVS mm-hmm. on sort of a long-term lease, actually, when they had several IVSers, maybe as many as four mm-hmm. in town at the same time, I think. Some of them had been doing youth work, organizing youth groups for community activities. Mm-hmm. So by the time I was there, there was only one other volunteer left who was doing that. Then there was a woman volunteer in the town too, who was teaching school, but she lived in another mm-hmm. separate.
Do you remember
household.
Who those were?
Sue Brannon was. Uh-huh. The teacher, mm. and she really tied into her teaching assignment. Really, just identified with the kids and mm-hmm. what was going on. It was a school that had been displaced from a village, mm-hmm. so they brought the school and found a location to kind of stagger on and still be giving classes to the kids from that country school. Mm-hmm. Octi Jacob was an OCTI. Who was Dutch-Indonesian. And that proved to be an important experience for me because that was the first thing that made me think about Indonesia. My wife and I eventually, after I got married, mm-hmm. we spent 2 years in Indonesia with a group mm-hmm. called Volunteers in Asia
uh-huh. yeah.
here at Stanford.
Yes, I think you're going to be famous in this study because you participated in the Peace Corps, in IBS, and Volunteers in Asia, which I think it's the trifecta, or whatever, the triple crown
yeah.
of overseas service, which is great. Yeah.
Been to Unitarian Universalist.
Or Brethren Volunteer Service, but with IVS that would be overkill, you know,
right.
to do one of those.
Yeah.
And so you and Octi lived in the same?
And Michelle Jacob for a time. Or Michelle would come over for meals, but I think he was living with a family that he'd gotten to know. But I don't know. Have you heard of Michelle Jacob?
No, but that may be okay. Because she's on the East Coast.
Yeah,
we divide up the interviews. So.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you have you in contact with her still?
Michelle was a guy.
Michelle. Oh, that's right. Of course. I know that. Right. I knew that. Right.
Okay.
And, but he's probably on the East Coast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. East Coast, or I guess last time I heard from him, he had been trying to set up a pig farm in the peninsular Malaysia or something like that. those are the folks who had been there. But I sort of closed it down. By the end of the year that I was there, the others had gone. Octi was down in Saigon, and Sue had gone home. Mm-hmm. And I didn't recommend that somebody replace me at the school where I was.
Because?
Did somebody come? Let's see. Hold on, I'm gonna have to back up on that. Mm-hmm. No, I wasn't replaced. No, mm-hmm. No. It just seemed that it was just so closed in, and the teaching situation, although all right, it wasn't crucial. You know, it was teaching a whole lot of classes. Mm-hmm. You know, a couple hours each class, you know, as far as teaching satisfaction goes, there wasn't a great deal of that either. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got your contacts and the experience that you're having, and you're doing okay, but it's not really something to tie into as a teacher.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had more than 50 students in a class? And
well, close to 50 mm-hmm. students, and a whole lot of classes mm-hmm. like that.
And you were teaching, you were teaching a kind of a English, conversational English?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. At two schools, the boys' school and then a girls' school, mm-hmm. a girls' high school.
So you taught at both schools?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so that's would be my day, going to one or the other or both mm-hmm. in the course of the day. I started a class, after school class for teachers. Mm-hmm. Which I thought would be fun and helpful. And it went for a couple sessions, but during one of the early sessions, there was a big crack sound that came through. And it turned out that the VC had dropped a mortar round into the market just close by the girls' mm-hmm. school where we had the class, and one of the people coming towards it was lightly wounded and just kind of got spooked at that point about coming, so we dissolved the class.
But that was in town. I mean, mm-hmm. would that mean they would be spooked to go anywhere in town?
Yeah. But it just seemed maybe kind of unlucky.
Nah, that's good. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd walk around the town to try and explore. Occasionally visits students and their families would invite me to their homes, which is one of the marvelous, warm experiences that I recall from mm-hmm. from Vietnam. One of the other things about Hoi An, there was an 8 o'clock curfew mm-hmm. at night, which wasn't common throughout the country. Mm-hmm. At night, you would hear the sounds of gunboats patrolling out on the river, mm-hmm. shooting around. There would be outgoing artillery rounds, just sort of done on who knows what schedule or basis. And then rarely, but it would happen, there'd be incoming mortar rounds, and then you'd dive down, go downstairs to where there was a little bunker set up with sandbags and things, and wait till
that.
What was
your bunker like in your house?
It was underneath sort of a platform bed, mm-hmm. and sandbags around it, and then a couple layers of stuff on the platform bed. Mm-hmm. Not a place to spend much time in, so I didn't.
And you were there for the full 2 years?
Just that first year that I was there.
Just the first. Oh, that's right. Just the first.
Yeah,
year.
The second year, I was. the Associate Chief of Party for Education, mm-hmm. which meant living in the IVS house mm-hmm. in Saigon and traveling around the country. It was mm-hmm. is great for getting a look at the whole country, mm-hmm. seeing good and the bad and the ugly. Mm-hmm. Visiting posts then not only where there were teachers, but also if I'm in a place going up to check out a teaching site or to make a station visit to a teaching volunteer, I'd drop by too and see any nearby IVS volunteers working in agriculture or mm-hmm. community development. So that extended what I was able to find out about and be curious in. Mm-hmm. So I'd spend maybe a third of my time out on the road and two-thirds in Saigon.
Mm-hmm. What did you do in Saigon?
In Saigon? Well, liaison with the AID overall education program, mm-hmm. which we were tied in with mm-hmm. on the education end. Actually, one of the things that I did while I was there was to get us out of the AID office downtown, mm-hmm. or the building that they had their office in, and get the education part moved out to the IVS compound, mm-hmm. Because we really didn't have a great deal to be doing down there among the AID types mm-hmm. In their building. Mm-hmm. That was an artifact of the days when they had 200 volunteers and teaching volunteers mm-hmm. just before the Tet Offensive. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of my goals, which we got done.
How many teaching volunteers were there when you were an associate chief?
Around 20, I think, something like that, 20, 25. We selected a new group and did a training program for them, you know, up in Da Nang and various things like that. Another was part of the time, for a couple of months, Hugh Mankey had come back to the United States, and so I was acting chief of party out there, and that was really interesting because that meant a lot of talks with officials at different levels and trying to deal with things like how do you handle the numerous break-ins, burglaries that have been taking place there at the IVS house, and there's somebody suspected, can we fire her or not, and go ahead and fire her, and, you know, just fun experimenting with that
boss.
Level of stuff. Yeah, yes. Being a boss for
uh-huh.
a while.
Especially since you had that position for a while,
mm-hmm.
Do you know what USAID or the Vietnamese government, how they felt about IVS then?
Well, I don't know. I'm trying to remember the name of our real benefactor and the guy who was our real contact person mm-hmm. in the Vietnamese government. He was in the Ministry of Agriculture. Really fought hard for us to be able to keep our compound, to keep our space there. I'm sorry, I just don't recall his name right now. Khan, maybe? Yeah, others would. But relationships with, you know, generally seem to be okay, despite the fact that you had a real split in, I suppose, outlook on the war and the whole activity itself. Mm-hmm. It didn't come down to a situation where it was seen as being anybody in opposition to anybody else. Mm-hmm. They're just kind of different perspectives. We had people in the IVS team who were gung-ho about America's presence in Vietnam and about this whole activity. Mm-hmm. And then you had others who were really strongly opposed to the war and to AID's general thrust. So it was kind of a weird situation. As an IVS volunteer, for example, we'd have our AID ID cards. Mm-hmm. You know, so we could go into officers' clubs. We could buy in BXs. If we needed to travel, we could go in and get Air America flights around. Mm-hmm. We could get on military standby flights. And so you've got access to that side. You know, and on the other side, often, if not directly, yourself, through other IVS volunteers, you would at least be hearing stories and feel a connection with people, Vietnamese especially, who are deeply angry at America's presence and what they were doing there. Mm-hmm. And so there was kind of an interesting tension in those relationships. Mm-hmm. And IVS at the time, on the staff there, we were working towards a model too of reducing the Americanness of IVS. And that was one of the really interesting, exciting things about being on the IVS staff at the time. Mm-hmm. Was okay, we've got this organization. How can you take what you've got and make it different and make it better? Mm-hmm. So one of the exciting things was the interaction with volunteers from a number of other countries, which at the time was a pretty exciting different model. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody from India, from you know the Netherlands. What was his name? Masafumi Nagao from Japan, who I think has still remained active in IVS things. Just a brilliant person, you know, Taiwanese. So it really was a multinational, multicultural experience mm-hmm. within IVS itself. And there in Saigon, you'd have these people sort of traveling through, sort of in the evenings, these great bull sessions and things that brought out a lot of new ideas. So it was pretty exciting. I considered extending for a third year, in fact. Kathy was here in the States. We'd met briefly while I was in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. I came back Christmas of the second year I was over there. And we got engaged, and we were going to go back to Vietnam together mm-hmm. To do a third year. But conditions in Saigon were becoming so chaotic at that time, not because of the communists, mm-hmm. but because of just disruption within the Vietnamese government and the disabled war veterans movement, which was occupying territory all around Saigon. The government was...
Including the area around the IVS house.
Including the area around the IVS house. Mm-hmm. You know, that was just a fascinating... but very disturbing process to be in. Anarchy is very disagreeable. And it's no place to be carrying on your first year of marriage. Mm-hmm. So we decided against that.
What did you do then, after your second year was over?
Came back to Massachusetts and taught social studies at Newton High School in Newton, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Kathy was teaching in Lexington. When he got married, Kathy wore a Vietnamese áo dài, mm-hmm. which I had sewed for her when we were over there. She had taken Vietnamese lessons. She'd gotten some tutoring and things when it looked like we were going to be going over there. And then I think it was maybe as late as April or May, right after she had already given word, I think, to her principal that she wasn't going to be coming back, mm-hmm. I said, you know, I think we shouldn't do this and we better stay there. So that's what we did. But then after that, Vietnam was still certainly a part of everything that I was doing and saying and friends that I had and people we'd meet. So I taught there for 2 years. And learned a bit more about China and Asia and various things while I was teaching that in my coursework. Then decided that we wanted to go to Southeast Asia together. Mm-hmm. And that's when we investigated volunteers in Asia mm-hmm. and went out there to a place without the war. And that was really important, to get to a place where you could get out and be taking hikes across the countryside. Mm-hmm. Learn stories about the war that had passed, mm-hmm. you know, tales about the Dutch, the war for independence the Indonesian war for independence against the Dutch, and mm-hmm. these various things, but still be free to move about.
Where were you? Where were you in Indonesia?
In Indonesia, in Sulawesi, which is a sort of scorpion-shaped island just north of Bali, basically, strongly Muslim area. So that was another important opportunity to live in a Muslim area, and that's been helpful to me in my teaching and being back here. Vietnam stayed a part of our lives in a number of ways. You know, workshops that we took and things. We got very excited about China back in 1971, 72, as it was just opening up, and the World Affairs Council had a teacher's workshop that extended for a full semester. Just wonderful things to be exposed to at that time. It was new and exciting and fresh. And we took Chinese language classes through Adult Ed there in Cambridge. Then when we were, it was funny, when we were in Indonesia, we met a young man who was going out to Vietnam as part of the Indonesian contingent that was supposed to be supervising the ceasefire arrangements, which really seemed kind of bizarre. Basically, it kind of drifted into the background for us for the time that we were in Indonesia. Then when we got out in 75, just as we were sort of April 75 coming across here, the whole thing collapsed there in Vietnam. And Kathy's from San Diego. That was our goal after coming back from Indonesia. We came back by Europe and the East Coast. And we got down to San Diego just as the refugees were starting to pour into Camp Pendleton. And we thought, sure, that somebody ought to realize that there is a need for English teachers with some experience, some knowledge of Vietnam, who knew some Vietnamese. And yet, there was no money yet from the federal government, so basically there was no program. It was just astounding to me, going to places where, you know, 6 months after I had been there and found, well, no, there are no jobs. No, there's nothing going on. No, we have no need for you, basically. Of course, within 6 months, they were crying for people with those kinds of experience. But I did teach summer school in Vista. Somebody had put together a small program up there. And then when Kathy and I came up to still looking for work here, we came to Palo Alto. And she got a regular teaching job, teaching ESL in San Jose. And I got a part-time job teaching in an elementary school nearby here, primarily because they had a handful of Vietnamese kids in the area. And there was some adult ed money for ESL instruction there. So that's kind of how we got our toehold here.
Then the handful became...
The handful remained a handful.
Remained a handful.
Yeah, here in Palo Alto. there were very few Vietnamese.
Yeah, whereas San Jose feels like downtown Saigon.
I mean,
it doesn't feel like it, but the signs certainly make you feel you're somewhere else, which is nice.
The connection...